The Tom Woods Show, episode 2041.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, chances are if you're listening to this podcast, you are surrounded by irrational, panicked people who think you're a terrible person because you don't want to lock everybody in their houses. No amount of reasoning appears to accomplish anything. And not to mention the media has done nothing but stoke fear and fail to provide context. Well, one of the many benefits you get as a supporter of The Tom Woods Show is membership inside The Tom Woods Show Elite. Recently migrated off Facebook, so if that was holding you back, no longer. This group will keep you sane and informed, and as an added bonus, it won't accuse you of wanting to kill your grandmother. Join me in there at supportinglisteners.com. Hey folks, Tom Woods here, Tom Mullen is back on the show today. He is the host of Tom Mullen Talks Freedom, and he has a brand new ebook. We just talked about one of his ebooks not too long ago, and this one is called It's the Fed, Stupid. So we're going to talk a little bit about one of our favorite topics, other than the virus topic, which I wish I didn't have to keep mentioning. And of course, we're talking about the Federal Reserve System. So that'll be a lot of fun, especially with Tom. So Tom, welcome back.
Great to be here, Tom.
I need you, for the sake of my podcast episode scheduling, to keep releasing an ebook per month, because that would cover one episode a month and that would help me out. So if you can just keep that going, I would be very happy. I liked the episode we did on your Christmas ebook. And by the way, I got some compliments emailed to me about my Jimmy Stewart impression.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I was happy about that. I very rarely get to do it. So that was a lot of fun. Anyway, this one, It's the Fed, Stupid, is written in a way that demonstrates the significance of the Fed chapter after chapter. But it's kind of one of the themes is that it's a significance that is missed by all the people who should be noting its significance, who are uniquely positioned to appreciate its significance. And they are the ones who least make notice of it. So that's what people like you and me are trying to fix. So, gosh, what was the first thing? A lot of times I ask people this and they tell me G. Edward Griffin. But do you remember the first thing you read that made you say, whoa, I never even really gave much thought to the Federal Reserve, but now I see it's something I need to be thinking and talking about? Do you remember when that was or what it was?
Well, it's funny because I think I told my becoming a libertarian story on one of your episodes. But in addition to that, I was sitting around the same time with a very prominent businessman, and believe it or not, a banker. And I don't mean a teller. I mean somebody who is reasonably high up. And I said, you know, there's something wrong about the Federal Reserve. I kind of had the read the newspaper understanding of it. And I asked these guys, how do you think it works? Neither one of them had any idea. Even the banker was kind of fuzzy. It just maybe the interest rate story. And when I had my Ron Paul revelation, you know, he started talking about it. And I said, I knew there was something wrong with that. And of course, it was him that really got me to start reading the Austrian economists that he was talking about here and there on his interviews. And it turned out that I discovered Ron Paul in 2007. The first thing I ever wrote about politics was an article called It's the Fed, Stupid, in 2008, that was on the local NPR website, believe it or not.
Ah, well, that's interesting. Yeah, now, of course, I'm on record. I have not removed the lourockwell.com blog post. Even if I wanted to, I'd never find it, where I said, you know, I'm not sure Ron Paul's doing the right thing, emphasizing the Federal Reserve. I mean, most people don't know about it or understand it. I think this is a loser. Okay, that has to be up there with I don't want to sign the Beatles because groups with guitars are on their way out. I mean, and that really is, that has to be the absolute doozy in the history of Tom Woods' blog posts. Because, of course, it turned out to be the opposite. And I actually think that it's not just his anti-war stance, but oddly enough, I think it was actually his stance on the Fed that helped to bring out a lot of people who had been sitting on the sidelines up to that point. I'm convinced of that.
No, it really hit me like a thunderbolt because, as I said, I had suspected there's something wrong with this before. And of course, like most people, I just thought I didn't understand it. And here's how much of an impact he had. I could still remember from his book, The Revolution, that he goes on and says, now, how does the Fed fund all these treasury notes that it buys? Well, it just writes a check on itself, creating the money out of thin air. And then he says, if that sounds fishy, then you understand it just fine. And I'm like, oh my God, yeah, of course. So like, I remember that from, like, I don't have the book here, I'm not reading out of it. I remember that from 14 years ago.
Let's dig into your, and that, just like your Christmas book, you can, if you want to, you can really read these chapters independently of each other, I think, because the themes are, they all run together, but you can get them bit by bit the way you present them. Let's start a little bit toward, let's say, in the first third of it or so. And you have a chapter called Why Aren't Prices Falling? And that, it's interesting that you title it that way, because most people are not, of course, asking that question. Most people think, as I did when I was growing up, that it's some kind of fact of nature that over time prices go up. It's just part of progress or something. And I couldn't have explained to you what the causal mechanism was, but I just knew that it's just normal, and that, you know, your grandparents are always going to tell you stories about buying an ice cream cone for a nickel, and that's just, you got to roll your eyes. That's just part of being alive. So the idea that prices ought to have been falling and I should be curious about that, well, they successfully kept that out of my mind.
Yeah, and when you look at, the Fed actually keeps records of this. So you could go on their website and see how they've so-called managed the dollar and managed price stability. And if you bought something for $10 in 1800, then that would cost about $5.50 in 1900. And that was the experience Americans have. And I don't think people realize how life transforming that could be, especially in a much more productive economy like we have now, where you could just stockpile cash and that could be your retirement. And not only would it not just lose all its value over time, it would be worth maybe twice as much. And in our economy, with the innovations, you know, increasing exponentially, it might be worth a lot more than twice as much as when you earned it in your 20s. So just that alone, price inflation is life transforming. And then, of course, the Fed does so much more damage.
Right. So, well, let's suppose that we had no Fed. The presumption of your question in this chapter is that if we had no Fed, maybe prices would be falling. Well, how would that work? Why would prices be falling?
Well, as the economy becomes more productive, we make more stuff, we are able to produce more services per capita, then, you know, you've got increasing supply that outpaces demand. And of course, that would make prices fall, as they did in the 19th century when we had this industrial revolution. Now, the Keynesians would tell us that the economy should have been overheating all the time. But, you know, that didn't happen. Karl Marx's prediction didn't come true. You know, the working class didn't revolt because they were so poor. Quite the opposite.
Well, if you had gold, it's true that the supply of gold does marginally increase every year, but not as much as the production of basically all other goods. So it's just a matter of a ratio that little bit of gold that you have is going to command ever more resources. And of course, now that applies all the more to something like Bitcoin, because Bitcoin, once there are 21 million Bitcoins, it cannot increase any further. And so another one of the things we hear is that it's actually, I mean, some people are acting like it's some new thing that the experts think inflation is good for us. It's good for that, because of course, first they're saying there's no inflation. Then they're saying, all right, yeah, there is some. And then they're saying, not only is there some, but it's good for you. That's actually not a new thing. They're just being dopier about the way they say it. Usually what they say is falling prices are a bad thing. They don't usually go to the psychotic extreme of the converse of that, say rising prices are a good thing. But normally what they say is falling prices are bad. Now, how do you convince people that falling prices are bad? How do you convince them of that? Well, maybe that's a rhetorical question. I don't even know. I don't even know if it is or not.
Yeah, and of course, people would go back to the Great Depression when, of course, prices were falling and money was getting more and more scarce. But this is only the reaction to the bubble that preceded it. So yes, in the very narrow time frame, if you've got this big, huge mortgage, let's say, that you took out under condition A while the Fed was blowing up a bubble, and then it collapses and it's harder to pay back, for that narrow window of time, it would be bad for you if you're in debt. Of course, they never say for all the savers that would be good. And of course, one of the things I talk about in the book is how over time and not like, you know, out on the margins, you know, where the economics really happen, the Fed is always encouraging us to borrow and consume and never to save and invest. And that's just another evil of the Fed.
I have done a number of episodes. Maybe I'll write a note to myself. I'll post them on deflation and why, as usual, something you're warned is a terrible catastrophe is fine. Like, it is actually not anything you have to worry about. And the thing they say is great, which is like a controlled inflation every year, is actually not good for the ordinary person. So I'll put that at tomwoods.com/2041. So they have convinced people to be wary of falling prices, but we would have had them in the absence of constantly increasing money supply. And the reasons that they give us for why it's bad for prices to be falling, they're just not good. And as I say, I'll post a little bit about that. But I want to jump a little bit around because I only have you for so much time. Let's talk about Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party. Now, these are people who think of themselves as being on the opposite side of things. But if they both had their eyes open, they would at least be able to admit that they have a common enemy in the Federal Reserve. They could both have that common enemy, or that, let's say, a common, so let's make it a little more positive, a common goal of getting rid of the Federal Reserve. Now, how can you, Tom Mullen, at least not in practice, but in theory, bring those two groups together right here on the Tom Woods Show?
Well, if we could get through to them that, you know, first of all, for Occupy Wall Street and their descendants, the Democratic Socialists, if they're convinced that income inequality and wealth inequality are the greatest evils that we have to rectify, and of course that goes with left-wing thinking all the way back to Rousseau, okay, you've tried. Okay, you've tried for 50, 60, 100 years, however, wherever you want to put the start line to just kind of redistribute wealth, and it's worse than ever, all right? But this is one institution that, if you understood it, is just transferring wealth upwards constantly. And it's using the same words that you said, you know, that you use, occupier, the common good, you know, this is going to be better for everybody and whatever. But I mean, it all goes to the billionaires. And when you trace the trajectory of when this income inequality started to really widen, it all goes back to when the dollar went off the gold standard. So if you zeroed in on that, are you going to get complete equality? No, but you're going to get a lot less inequality with a honest money system where everybody's got to save in order to invest, including the billionaires. Then they have to convince somebody to give them their money for interest rather than just steal it basically silently through the Fed.
So that's a part of central banking that I think most people miss. We'll just put it that way. There's a guy who, when I knew him several years ago, he was a PhD candidate. He may actually be a professor by now. I haven't kept up with him, but Louis Rouanet actually did some work on this, on the subject of monetary policy and inequality and exactly how inequality is driven by it. So I may actually also link to his piece on that as well. There's just so, it's an embarrassment of riches here. And yet, as we've indicated from the beginning, because there's some weird allergy to discussing the Fed, it's left to you and me. I mean, people like, you know, Tom Mullen and Tom Woods here have the field to themselves, with, you know, with a couple dozen economists here and there. But honestly, it's been very successfully kept out of the public consciousness. Or if people do become conscious of it, they have this sense that if they were to critique it, they would be some kind of weirdo conspiracy person, and they know that that's the worst possible thing they can be. But the thing is, you don't have to be. I mean, I think there is a good conspiracy argument for the Fed. I mean, when a bunch of bankers meet under assumed names in an isolated place and draft legislation, I'm going to assume that's not for the common good, okay? I mean, I don't see why a progressive wouldn't agree with me on that. But you can just look at the economic effects of it and see what the problems are. And you know what? You know what? I'm also, okay, I want everybody to get it's the Fed stupid because it's persuasive and it's written at a level that an ordinary person can understand. The problem that a lot of economists have when they are good on this subject is they're using this crazy lingo that nobody uses, that no one can follow. But I do want to put, let's see, what else do I want to put up here? Well, I'll think about it, but there's at least one other piece. Yeah. Now, here's an interesting one. George Selgin he's kind of eclectic. I don't think he even calls himself an Austrian economist anymore, but he's very sympathetic and a fellow traveler. And in 2010, maybe, he gave a talk called "Has the Fed Been a Failure?" And it was one of the most impressive papers I have ever seen delivered. And he went through and actually went through the numbers. Have we had fewer recessions? Have we had more shallow recessions? Has this happened? Has that happened? All these sorts of things that we kind of assume, well, the experts have been in charge since we had the Fed. Things must have been better. He actually went and looked, and it turns out the results aren't good. So I'm going to have a bunch of stuff at tomwoods.com/2041. I found, by the way, when I published the book Meltdown in 2009, that the Tea Party audiences didn't know much about the Fed, but they were willing to listen. And I think they were at a point that a lot of people are at now after COVID. They feel like, geez, after what just happened to us, I'm willing to consider anybody's theory. And likewise, right after the financial crisis, people were willing to consider anything. They really had open minds. So, you know, I hope we can just keep them open. All right, I'm talking too much. Let's go to interest rate. Now, I think we all know, what is the origin story of that chapter?
Well, that was actually something that I wrote for Fee, and I wanted to include it in the book, Fee being the Foundation for Economic Education. And it was kind of a takeoff on Leonard Reed's iPencil.
Yeah.
But instead of the pencil telling you how central planning was not necessary, nor would it have helped to create a pencil, that central planning, of course, is not necessary and is actually harmful when you talk about interest rates and the money supply.
So with iPencil, we can trace that through, and we see at the very beginning, the pencil argues that, I'm not sure I'm remembering the Leonard Reed version or the Milton Friedman popularization, as it's been so long since I looked at it, but kind of suggests, and this was the way I used to explain it to students, that there's no way anybody knows what's involved in making a pencil. And initially your thought is, oh, come on. Of course somebody knows how to make a pencil. How would we have so many of them? But then when you actually understand what they're saying, that it's not just a matter of you go get some wood and you put some rubber on the top. Well, how'd they get the rubber? And what services did they use for that? And how did they refine the oil to power the vehicles that carry the rubber or put the rubber on the tire of those vehicles? But, I mean, it's an enormous, impossible amount of information for anybody to know or to coordinate. But how is that true of an interest rate? Just seems like a dinky little number.
Well, it's the same thing, that interest rate is the result of millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions, depending on, you know, what jurisdiction you're looking at, of decisions by individuals basically pursuing their happiness, which is something that, first of all, it seems like all of our central planners just would rather we didn't do. And that doesn't matter whether you're talking COVID or the economy or specifically the money supply and the interest rates. But every time that the Federal Reserve, you know, tries to affect the interest rate, it's really overriding individual decisions somewhere. And of course, it never ends well because, you know, just like the central planner of the dairy industry cannot know how much milk there is supposed to be. No, these central planners they can't know, you know, where are the savings out there, where they say they do, but they don't. And they can't tell you what the rate should be. Should people have a 5% savings rate at this moment in time, or should it be 6%? Well, that's the product of all those millions and billions of decisions. And just like you end up with too much cheese and not enough milk when they central plan dairy, you end up with too much of something when they central plan the interest rate, and we call that malinvestment. And then, of course, when reality sets in and we find out that this malinvestment is not going to be profitable, just that's when we have all these disasters. And, you know, again, going back to the people that are out there advocating for the little guy, if you went into the housing industry, let's say you were 25, and you went in there as an entry-level person saying, you know, I don't know what I want to do. I'm going to get into this. They're hiring. And you spent 2 or 3 years and maybe even became a contractor with a little crew, a subcontractor, whatever. You've invested at that point 10% of your life in this, and then it's gone. I mean, it's not just the fact that you're unemployed for a while. You've just wasted years of your life that could have been invested in something else, and now you've got to go back almost and start over. And that's a dead loss for that person, for that industry, for the economy as a whole.
I think the way, that's very well put, by the way, to reach the Tea Party people on this is to keep it just at the level you described, that they would be the first to say that if the government controlled milk prices, it would be a disaster of discoordination. They will see that, but it's just never occurred to them. I don't think they have a full-blown theory as to why it's okay to manipulate interest rates. I don't think they know it's happening. So if you say, but the very same argument would appear to suggest that we shouldn't think we can fine-tune the economy by manipulating interest rates any more than we could manipulate the structure of prices to plan the economy, I think that's almost all they need to hear. It's just from Conservatism, Inc., they are certainly not hearing it. And I might add that that's what gave me an opening to reach them, because the conservative movement, so-called, had really no answer when the financial crisis of 2008 hit. They had no idea what was going on. All they could think of was maybe this was caused by the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977. Now, I'm not saying that was a brilliant piece of legislation, but this is 2008 and that's 1977. I mean, you can't do any better than that. It was very, very unimpressive, which is part of the reason I got so many radio invites and stuff, because these hosts were desperate for somebody who could rub two brain cells together to explain to them what the heck was going on. So if you say in chapter two of your book, the Federal Reserve runs the economy, this is the way a lot of our people speak. That sounds kind of over the top. In what sense does the Federal Reserve run the economy?
Well, you know, most people believe that if they vote the right way and they get the right person in the White House, no less, that something's going to be different. But when you really pull back and look at, you know, unemployment for the whole 21st century, let's say, or you look at any of the things that these presidents brag that, you know, you should give them credit for, you know, you really, you take the years away and you can't tell when, you know, one president gets elected and another one leaves. And it's the same really with who controls Congress. And my point is that since we've been in the New Deal regulatory structure where the executive branch is just writing thousands of rules, and when a president comes in, he gets rid of 20 of them, and then the next guy, you know, puts those 20 back. And that, along with the fact that the Fed is not restrained at all by the gold standard or a Bitcoin standard or anything else, it's just pure fiat, that really what politicians do have no effect. And I put up plenty of charts in the book to show people, look at this chart. Tell me, if I took the years away, be honest with yourself, would you be able to pick out where your favorite president came in or left? And of course, nobody could. It's a little like your COVID chart thing, Tom. It's the same thing, because you see this everywhere. Oh, look, we did this thing and unemployment fell. And, you know, okay, well, it was falling for the previous 6 years and it didn't fall any faster after you did your thing. So obviously that couldn't have had any effect. I mean, that just jumps out at you everywhere when you look at these macroeconomic indicators. But what it is consistent with, what you could see when you look over decades, is that when the Fed's inflating, things go up. When we hit a bust, they go down. And then the Fed starts inflating again. They've got us on this roller coaster. And of course, prices always just keep going up. So the average Joe's out there, yeah, eventually he's making as much money as would have been enough 2 years ago or 5 years ago, but his wages are always rising slower than the prices. So he's kind of on a hamster wheel. So again, this is all for the common good. Supposedly, that's the only way we can create jobs. I mean, I argue that's malarkey.
Hey folks, the monetary system is screwed up, as Tom Mullen and I are emphasizing today, but that's not the only screwed up institution in American society. Healthcare is pretty screwed up too. So I want to thank our sponsor, CrowdHealth. Open enrollment is ending soon, but a lot of people are still searching for their best healthcare option. And we libertarians know how broken the current system is. And that's what makes CrowdHealth so valuable. It offers you a flexible and affordable healthcare option without the hassle of insurance. So while you're shopping around, don't forget to head to joincrowdhealth.com/99 to find out how CrowdHealth can save you 40 to 60% in healthcare costs each year. So remember, CrowdHealth isn't health insurance. It's a modern way to pay medical expenses. It's a community of people who are tired of paying into an obviously broken system. And being in the CrowdHealth community can save hundreds of dollars monthly and put thousands of dollars back in your pocket. It's super simple. You use their app and you can find nearly any doctor in the country with a quality ranking score. Scan your bills and just throw them away. CrowdHealth takes it from there. press a button to receive virtual care anytime, anywhere. CrowdHealth is able to offer amazing prices because of its community of health-conscious members. But they have an amazing offer just for my listeners. Get your first 6 months for just $99 per month. That's a savings of almost 50% off their standard pricing and a lot less than one of those crappy high deductible plans. Just go to joincrowdhealth.com/99 and enter code WOODS at sign up. That's joincrowdhealth.com/99, promo code WOODS. CrowdHealth is not health insurance. It's a community-powered alternative. Terms and conditions may apply. You have a chapter, in fact, it's your last one before the appendices, Everyone Should Want to End the Fed. And I want to touch on that a minute because I've singled out a couple of groups of people who might have particular ideological reasons for wanting to end the Fed. But although we can make arguments tailored to those audiences, there are plenty of things we can say that any person, regardless of his state in life, or, I mean, other than people who, let's say, maybe are employees of the Federal Reserve, of which I believe there were something like 23,000, maybe they don't want to end the Fed, and maybe people who get special advantages from it. But the average person who is not connected to any of this should be persuadable on this issue, at least in principle. At the very least, they should think to themselves, if this thing is a necessary evil, it is nevertheless an evil. I think we can get there. How do you propose doing that in that chapter?
Well, the first thing is to just try and show people that when we didn't have an unrestricted money supply, there was more upward mobility. So I guess I'm speaking to the left here, that if you want more opportunity for, there's even a story I have about a woman who was born a slave and actually out of slave wages was able to buy her and her son's freedom and actually ended up being, you know, quite well off. And another woman from the 19th century who was born to rather modest circumstances, but accumulated savings from being a seamstress, just sewing, you know, fee for service, and eventually opened up a chain of stores. I mean, she opened a store and then it grew and it was successful. Another one. There's no way that somebody with a real average income today, I shouldn't say there's no way, it's very difficult if you're making $15, $18 an hour, much less seven or 10, that you're going to put aside savings enough to start a little business and grow it into an empire. You know, it could be done, or you can go out and convince somebody and borrow the money. It's very way harder than it was in the 19th century. And these were women in a time when, you know, women were generally not given the same opportunities, or at least society did not expect them to. So yeah, if you're a left winger, you should recognize that before we had this system, it was easier for upward mobility, and that, you know, you've tried what you say. I don't know, how many more years is it going to be? How many more programs? We had the war on poverty. We had Obamacare. Is healthcare affordable? No. Now we have to do another thing. You know, I'm speaking to you. Stop doing what doesn't work and try this, because this is really where all the leverage is. And I guess for the right, I would say kind of the same thing. You've been electing Mitt Romney's and, well, we didn't elect him. We nominated him. I shouldn't say we. I didn't vote for him. But you've tried to elect these quote-unquote small government conservatives. The budget keeps going up. You really can't tell a difference when the Republicans are in control, other than spending goes up faster than when the Democrats are in control. Usually that's when there's a Democrat president and a Republican Congress who hates his guts. That's the only time spending ever slows down. So how long are you going to keep running this? Letting the, as you call them, Tom, conservative ink, how long are you going to keep buying their baloney, or say, none of that worked? So let's look at somewhere we might have more leverage. This is where the leverage is. You can't have the government that we have without the Federal Reserve.
So there are definitely ways to reach particular kinds of people, talking to them about this. And yet there's one argument that I think can appeal to anybody, left or right. And to me, it's this. If you want to save for the future, you know as well as I do that if you just pile up green dollar bills, that in 30 years, they will lose a third of their value, even if inflation, price inflation, is kept to very, very low levels. That accumulates over time. So how are you going to build up a nest egg that by the time you need it is one third lower than when you started, or half worth half of what it was when you started. How are you going to do that? Whereas before the Fed, people didn't have to do that. They didn't have to say, well, if I sit on my money, it's going to be worth less, so I better go get in the stock market. Maybe people don't want to be in the stock market. Why should they have to do that just to break even? Whereas when gold and silver coins circulated as money, they held or increased their value. So all you had to do was hold on to them. Now, you could make an even bigger return if you invested them and did other things with them. But at the very least, you weren't punished for being conservative and concerned about your future and your family's future. You could just hold them. I don't see how anybody, again, other than a bought and paid for person, doesn't at least admit that's a problem. And that without a Fed, we'd be much, much closer to a solution.
Absolutely. It's life transforming. Just the price inflation alone, which is not even the beginning of all the problems the Fed creates, just that alone would change the lives of 99% of society. Both sides now, even the right now is more populist and they're fighting for the working people. They're saying this is where you have tremendous leverage to change their lives positively, exponentially. Not going in there and tweaking something, getting rid of some little regulation. And the other thing I'd say is nobody likes billionaires. Of course, you and I like to distinguish, of course, well, how did they become a billionaire? But if you don't like billionaires, look at all the crashes and look at their net worth before, and not necessarily the day after the crash, but a year after the crash. Their net worth keeps going up, all right? And everybody else is in a funk and in desperate straits. So, you know, a lot of people, you know, when the crash happened in Florida, where I lived at the time, you know, people's houses were underwater for over a decade or more. So this kills average people. And, you know, the billionaires always come out smelling fine. Hey, they'd still be billionaires in an honest economy with an honest monetary system, but the difference wouldn't be anywhere near as great. And they'd have earned it honestly. And most people, you know, then would not resent them.
Exactly. All right. Well, the book is It's the Fed, Stupid. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/2041. But apparently there are a couple ways people can get it. So tell us about that.
Well, you can download a PDF ebook for free if you just go to itsthefedstupid.com, and you'll ask you for your email list. And anybody who's a Tom Woods listener knows you want to be on that list, even mine, after you're done with Tom's. You could come over to the other Tom and read something interesting. And you can also get it. There'll also be a link there where if you want a paperback copy or maybe one or two to hand out to your friends, you can buy it off Amazon. And I've got it priced in a non-inflationary price to make it easy for you.
Okay, good, good, good. I'll give people both those options at tomwoods.com/2041. I'll also link them to your brand new podcast, which is called?
Tom Mullen Talks Freedom.
All right. I will have a link to that also. Of course, people can find that on any podcasting app, I presume?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right. Well, so now, Tom, I'd love to keep you on here, but I don't want to keep you from your next project, which is February's ebook, so that you can come back on the Tom Woods Show. So go get cracking on that, and thanks a lot. Good luck.
I'll do my best, and thank you, Tom.
All right, everybody. Remember, coming up February 1st, I have an extremely important announcement. I will not be making it on the podcast, but it is a very important announcement and it could affect you very substantially. So I promise you this will not be a waste of your time. I promise me you will say, thank you, Woods, for telling me about the announcement. If you want to hear the announcement, be one of the first to hear it, then head over to tomwoodsannouncement.com. This is the best I can do. I've been thinking all throughout my time as a libertarian, what is the best thing I can do for the libertarian folks out there? And up to now, the best thing I could do was to correct the historical record and to help people understand history and to a lesser extent economics better and more clearly and more thoroughly and truthfully. Now I think we need other things too. Although I am very happy with what I've done in those other areas and with academic subjects, I think the kinds of challenges we face require us to shift our emphasis a little bit. And that's what I'm doing here with my announcement, which I think has the potential to help an awful lot of people who are struggling living in a society that despises them. Get the announcement, tomwoodsannouncement.com. Sign up and you will get the announcement February 1st, 9 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time. tomwoodsannouncement.com. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.